Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year, all Black, Latino, and Native American authors combined wrote 7% of children's books in the United States. That's according to the Cooperative Children's Book Center, a research institute out of the University of Wisconsin. The paucity of diversity among authors of children and young adult literature is reflected in the scarcity of multicultural characters and stories. That's what we're talking about and why that matters today. Joining us is selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Chrissy Harris. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Ohio State professor Molly Blackburn, who studies literacy, language, and social change. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Molly, what does the research say about the importance of diversity in literature for children? I mean, I grew up in the Dick and Jane era, and I'm not sure. How did it affect me?
Right. So a former colleague of mine, Rudine Sims Bishop, who is emeritus professor at Ohio State, spoke about it most eloquently, in my opinion. She studied African American children's literature, and her study spanned decades. Mm-hmm. And she noted that some books serve as mirrors, while others serve as windows, and other times even doors where readers can walk themselves into the worlds of others. And she argued, and I'm quoting her, children have a right to books that reflect their own images and books that open less familiar worlds to them. So plainly.
So diversity is a two-sided coin.
It is. Okay. All children need literature that provide all of these mirrors, windows, and doors. So that's the metaphor that I work with.
And what do we mean by diversity for the purposes of children? And, you know, I'm just going to say children's literature, but I'm including young adult and adolescent, that whole thing.
Right. Thank you. I understand diversity broadly. I would certainly foreground, as you did in your introduction, race and ethnicity, but I also include sexual identity or gender identity and religious diversity, linguistic diversity. So I try to really think of it broadly.
Economic diversity?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And Chrissy Harris, is there a metric that you use in the library business to figure out what proportion should be representative of diverse literature?
We don't have any numbers that we're trying to hit, but for some areas, especially Muslim Americans or things like that, we try to buy everything that there is that's perfect for a library, something that's in hardcover or something like that. If it's a picture book, we're still looking to stick to our library standards because we don't want something that's going to fall apart. But if something is really good, we still will make an exception. There are some areas where there's just not much published, so we try to get everything there is.
Do you compete in terms – and I don't mean compete economically, but do you compare, I should guess is the better way. Do you compare what's available at the bookstores?
When we're at bookstores, we're definitely looking at
what they have
on display. Uh-huh. So if there's something that we missed, we'll take a look and see why don't we have that. We're always on the clock kind of in that way, that we're always looking what is on Amazon or in Barnes & Noble. But I think bookstores and the library are perfect complements to each other.
What makes a diverse book? It's not just that there's a face of color in the book or a topic necessarily.
Right. No, it can't. Actually, that's also a critique that Sims Bishops make, is it can't just be about skin color. It's got to be about family and community and culture and the way that people interact together, and so that it's not a single identity. It worries me when I go to a book that's like just fits in this one category, because no human being just fits in one category. And so I'm looking for intersectionality, but not like a checklist of identities. I want complexity, and I want nuance in books that I understand as diverse books.
There's a book by Jacqueline Woodson. We were talking about the famous author, children's adolescent book author, Harbor Me, which seems to kind of do that seamlessly, where there's a lot of kids in a room and they're in a special class, and you don't really get hung up, and it eventually kind of seamlessly tells each of their stories in a way that doesn't feel contrived.
And I do think you have to watch out. That's what you have to watch out for. And she's such a skillful author.
Just like with their vegetables, they don't want to know that they're reading something good for them, right?
right. And it takes such a skillful author, and I think Jacqueline Woodson does an amazing job at that.
I agree, yes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about diversity in children's literature. And by children's literature, I mean adolescent, young adult, and for small children. My guests, Chrissy Harris, she's selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Also with us, Molly Blackburn. She's an Ohio State professor. She studies literacy, language, and social change. We would love to hear from our listeners out there. If you have a great book, you want to give us a couple titles and share what you've learned. If you have children, tell us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do you raise awareness among parents when it comes to your role in the library, Chrissy Harris, about the importance of this?
The first thing is making sure the books are in the library system, so finding those books and selecting them. So that's my role and the other selectors. And then we need to share with the people in the branches, our staff in the branches, what's out there so they can really highlight it with parents and teachers who are also coming in. So we do that highlighting by displaying. We really make a point of displaying diverse books. And we do that through book lists, any lists that we do. We also do teacher collections, and we'll try to include diverse books in those as well.
And, you know, culturally, things have got – we're still talking about 7% of the writers are of color, are diverse, represent some kind of diverse or minority population, Molly Blackburn. But 7% today is 7% more than there maybe was 50 years ago.
Right. We are making progress, and I feel like there are authors of color creating their work. We just need to get them taken up and sold and purchased by families and libraries so that they are so that they're getting the recognition and so that kids are learning what they need to learn about people in the world.
What role do publishers play in all of this?
Well, they decide what is going to get sold, so and how it's going to be marketed, right?
Yeah.
And whether it gets and to whom it gets marketed. And so what I want is for publishers to take up young authors of color, for example, and value the strengths that they bring to their writing, but also foster the qualities that they need to make marketable books. Like I want people to. The books to sell and for the authors to make money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chrissy?
There's a couple publishers that are really making strides. There's Salaam Reads that features Islamic or Muslim authors. Coquila is a new imprint at Penguin Young Readers, and they're actually going to be soliciting unrepresented manuscripts for 4 months a year.
So without agents?
Without agents, yes. So that would reach a lot of people that don't have that agent already or are just starting to write, and they're giving them an opportunity that they wouldn't have had.
But is that crazy? I mean, how can they even do that? I mean, that sounds – that's a lot.
That is a lot. We'll see how it – they're new, so we'll see how it works for them. But it's a great goal. So September through December is what they're planning on doing.
And it sounds risky, but it seems like a risk worth taking, and there's a market for it, and there's an importance to it. So I hear the risk, but it feels really exciting to me.
You know, from what you're seeing in children's literature today, is this a thing now? I mean, it's still an amazingly small percentage, but it seems like what's coming out, at least the books we do see, whether they're written by people of color or people from minority communities, ethnic, religious, whatever it might be, it still seems like almost every book seems to be working at that.
I think so. And I think 2018 was a banner year for awards. So the awards that were awarded in 2018 for books that were published in 2017, just so much diversity in those awards. And it does take a little bit of time for books to come through the pipeline. So I'm hoping that these awards that were awarded this year will just spur more. And in 5 years, we're going to be seeing so many more books by diverse authors.
So culturally, have we changed our appetite for books and what children want to read about?
I hope so. Most of my work focuses on LGBT youth. And so to me, it seems like yes, it's absolutely changed, but it felt like there was a little more acceptance a little while ago. So maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I would see less tension around people using LGBT books in their classrooms. Uh-huh. And right now, I work in the College of Education, so I think in terms of classrooms. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like maybe there's a little more pushback, particularly since same-sex marriage was approved on a federal level. So I think that
a little more heightened awareness.
I think there's
change,
but there's a little bit more pushback in that particular regard. I do think the recognition that particularly authors of color are getting for their scholarship has improved, and I am thrilled about that.
Well, I mean, they're talking about the next gen being 50% non-white.
Right.
They have to get cooking.
That's right.
To feed that appetite.
Exactly. If they want to sell their books, they need to make their books resonate with the people who are going to be buying them.
Do you see other big publishers like Penguin having alternate imprints like you were talking about? Is that a trend?
The Salaam Reads is a Simon & Schuster okay. imprint, so that one is there. I don't know of any others offhand, but I know that they are working on their diversity. I think Scholastic has a program. And then Lee and Lowe is a long-standing publisher that's always been committed to diversity. And they do a lot with classrooms and libraries.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about diversity in children's literature, adolescent literature, young adult literature. If you have a question or comment about that, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd like to hear what your recommendations are out there. So you can also go to Facebook and post a question, comment, or your suggestion for a good read with diversity on our Facebook page. My guests, Chrissy Harris, she's selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library, and also Molly Blackburn, she's an Ohio State professor who studies literacy, language, and social change. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of diversity of characters and stories in children's and young adult literature. Reading from an early age is critical for child development. We know that. But if kids and young adults don't see themselves in the characters or the stories, they may not relate to the books. They might put them away. Still with us is selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Chrissy Harris, and OSU professor who researches literacy, language, and social change, Molly Blackburn. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about the illustrations? How big of a deal is that? Is that pretty much everything as the younger the child is?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah,
tell
definitely.
Me some good examples of well-illustrated books. Chrissy
well,
Harris.
Molly and I actually both brought the same yeah. book, Crown, oh. An Ode to the Fresh Cut, written by Derek Barnes and illustrated by Gordon C. James. And the illustrations are just beautiful. The book is about a young black boy who goes to the barbershop and gets a really great haircut, and he's just feeling really great. And so Gordon C. James, I believe, was a painter and had never illustrated kids' books before, but I think someone just asked him if he would illustrate this children's book. And
oh wow, beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's been winning awards like mad. So it just took someone to approach someone who never would have thought about illustrating a children's book. And I mean, we've been Molly just showed a full page spread of the illustrations. It's beautiful. So just a celebration of the
what's
haircut.
Beautiful about it.
Well, the illustrations are this thick paint. And it's also just so realistic. So they're showing getting the haircut. They're showing all the other men and women that are there.
And with all their different kinds of haircuts.
Everyone's looking really great, and it's just a celebration.
It opens up with an image that reminds me a lot of Kehinde Wiley's artwork, where there's an African-American boy who's looking very proud, and he's got this background of this floral print that you often see.
That's the painter that painted the Obamas.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right, That's exactly right. Yeah, and so I just love the way that conjures all of these, like, this legacy of, like, African-American heroes and pride and confidence. And I'm just like, yes, it's such a great
show. And just a happy kid. There's nothing cuter than a happy kid. Right.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I also think the illustrations can say a lot about the authenticity of the representation. And so that when I see an illustration that looks hyperbolic in some way or feels like it looks just like a white kid, it just happens to have brown skin, that sends a red flag for me. It's like, I'm kind of watching this book a little more closely.
What does that tell you? Chrissy Harris, you were nodding. What is that telling you?
Well, for a while, we've said that we're looking for books that show children of all races and ethnicities, and they're just going about their everyday lives. But we don't want books that erase part of that person's self. So if you're making them just like a white person but with a different color skin and ignoring all other differences, then you're not really representing that person.
For instance, in Crown, that's a book about a really important aspect culturally in his community. The barbershop.
Exactly.
It's not trying to run away from who he is and where he comes from. It's celebrating it. Yes. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. And also not showing an author's or illustrator's ignorance of the community, where somebody just might not know the importance of the barbershop in the life of an African-American boy.
Which brings us to the issue of the paucity of diversity among authors. I mean, 7%. What do you make of that? Is this a process? Molly Blackburn, is this a process of enough people seeing themselves in books to know that, hey, I can write a book? This can be me too?
I think so. I think that more and more students and readers and writers of color are being raised where they are seeing themselves, and they have the and are more prepared to write and illustrate books that represent their communities and than themselves.
And in picture books especially, I think parents fall back to what their favorites were as kids. And so So you need to seek out things that are maybe new classics. Please Baby Please by Spike Lee. I mean, that is now a classic. So you need to find books like that. And that needs to be for all parents, not just African-American parents that are looking for those books for their kids, so that white kids can also learn about the world.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's that door, right?
Right, right. Door and window and mirror, yep. Yeah. I read Please Baby Please with both of my kids, and it was like a family favorite.
Spike Lee wrote it. I've never seen it.
It's delightful, and the illustrations, I think, are stunning.
It's one of those simple books that parents are always looking for, and it's just such a happy, happy book to read with your kids.
It also captures some parent frustration, which I really appreciate as a parent. Yes.
There's a double entendre going on then.
Please, baby, please, let's go home.
Right. Yeah, I'm out of there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, Molly Blackburn, Ohio State professor, studies literacy, language, and social change. And also Chrissy Harris. She's a selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. So she helps pick out what you get to check out at the library. And we're talking about diversity in literature for children, young adults, adolescents. Do you have a question or comment? Give us a call now, 614-292-8513. We'd also like to get your suggestions, run them by my two experts here and see what they have to say about what makes good diverse literature for children and young adults. The email address is allsides@wosu.org. How do kids react? What do we know about how children actually react to this kind of literature? Have there been any studies, Molly Blackburn?
Sure. Actually, several authors talk about it. So A.S. King, who wrote Still Life with the Tornado, talks about how sometimes parents will react and think that books are – she uses the word dangerous for their kids. And Shimon Alexie writes about that too, about how we want to protect particularly privileged kids from some diverse themes that seem maybe make some people more uncomfortable, but the kids don't. The kids are like ready to read it and talk about it, and they are taking up really complex and themes that people are really conflicted about. So maybe around refugees, for example, and are able to read and think and talk about it in ways that show such compassion and depth that to me it seems like, well, of course we want this with our kids.
I have a book here, Carmela Full of Wishes by Matt De La Pena and illustrated by Christian Robinson, and it is about a girl who Carmela who is full of wishes, and one of her wishes is that her mom can get her papers fixed so she can I think it's her mom or her dad to get the papers fixed so she can stay in the United States. And it's just a book about the things that she wants. First, she's thinking about wishing for a candy machine like all kids, unlimited candy, but then she thinks about something serious. And Molly is right. I mean, I think that parents may think it's a bigger deal than it is. Kids are probably hearing about this on the news anyway, about caravans from Mexico and things like that. This book is a great opportunity to actually talk to them and discuss it in a calm manner instead of hearing it secondhand and the kids not knowing what's going on.
It's so interesting to me that parents worry about what their kids think. And it, I always wonder, do they forget how aware they were as children? And I guess we do, don't we?
Right, right. Yeah, Sherman Alexie says that he says that he writes not to protect kids, privileged or otherwise, but instead to give them weapons in the form of words and ideas that will help them fight their monsters. I write in blood because I remember what it felt like to bleed. And your point about maybe parents are just not remembering what that feels like.
How aware children are and how alive they are to the possibilities. Tell me about a time when you gave a kid a book that feature diverse characters, maybe it's your own children, but that where you saw it, that it had an effect on them.
At a lot of our branches, we have a lot of Muslim customers, Somali Americans, and we had one book in particular, Mommy's Kimar, and so the woman on the cover is wearing a headscarf, and I just had so many people telling me that kids saw that and lit up, and they just like kind of ran for the book.
Someone who looks like their mom.
Exactly. Yeah. They were so excited.
I had the opportunity to teach an LGBT themed literature course at a local high school, and we started the course with memoirs. I was really trying to get students to write memoirs, but we read Magenta.
Is it Beyond Magenta?
Beyond Magenta, that's exactly right, by Cookland, Susan Cookland. And it's a photo book of adolescents who are trans and stories of interviews with Cookland and the young people. And a kid in that class, so a trans young man who just didn't speak in class, spoke around those stories. So, like, he had insights to provide our interpretation of those stories that nobody else in the class had, and it was really beautiful to watch him.
It gave him a mirror.
Yeah.
And a door for others.
Right. He was allowed to, like, open the door for others in a way, you know, that he was like, I have expertise here that I can share with you. Not in a way that was, you know, where he had to do it. He could have said nothing and it would have been fine. But he chose to do it as a result of, in conjunction with that book.
It kind of empowered him to do it.
Absolutely.
Let's see. Missy and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Missy.
Hey, I just wanted to call in. I'm listening to the show. I love the show. And my children are older now, but when they were in preschool years ago, one of my favorite books and their favorite book is called The Shortcut. I cannot remember who the author is, but definitely a diversity in that book. And I just wanted to call that in and see maybe if you guys knew who that author was.
Tell us what it's about.
Well, it's about kids walking home from school and their big mama told them not to take the shortcut, which is along the railroad track, and it goes through a tunnel. It reminded me of situations that I had in my life as kids walking home. Sure enough, they take the shortcut that they're not supposed to, and a train is coming through the tunnel. And they run, and at the end it says, No one talked. You know, they got off the tracks just in time. No one talked about it afterwards. They kept walking home in silence, and no one told Big Mama.
It's by Donald Cruz, C-R-E-W-S.
Who is it? Cruz?
C-R-E-W-S.
All right. I highly recommend that book.
It's a Mulberry Books Award. I don't know if it's right. All right. Well, Missy, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate that. Anybody else out there has a suggestion for a book that they enjoyed that kind of speaks to this issue of diversity for children, adolescents, young adults, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are you familiar with that book? Or
no, I want to read it. Are you familiar with it, Chrissy?
Yeah, Donald Cruz is a very popular picture book author.
Uh-huh. He's
a little older, which is why Missy probably read that to her children.
Back in the day.
Yep.
Yeah. And it seems like it's a story about real kids, because I think we've all sort of been there where we didn't do something that we were told. We learned why we shouldn't do it, but we never told Big Mama.
No.
what are some of the other ideas? You have a whole stack of books in here.
One of the things, when we were talking about illustrations around books and authenticity, so there's a hashtag of own voices, right? And so when books are written by and illustrated by the people who are represented, people like who share characteristics with the people represented in the book.
Uh-huh.
And Julian is a Mermaid is a complicated one to me. So Julian is a Mermaid is a picture book by
Julian.
Jessica Love.
Okay, gotcha.
And it's she wrote and illustrated the book. I shared this book in my children's and young adult lit class. I opened up with it, but Jessica Love is not own voices, right? So she is a white woman who is representing this young kid of color. What it represents gender creativity in a way that I find just stunning. Like we're looking at a picture now where. He is he has a skirt that's kind of like an octopus, and he's being led by a stingray and all of these.
It's
fish
his
are
imagination.
Through the water. Yes, he's imagining.
It's how he's visualizing himself.
Right. And some people critique the illustrations for being too hyperbolic. And so it's one of these books that I both love, and then as a white person, I like reflect and think, okay, what am I missing? What do I need to learn? And so to me, a big part is not just finding own voices, I think that's important, but also being in conversation with people who are also looking and talking about these books and giving you insights that maybe you didn't have before and listening, just listening to what people have to say about them. I know it's a book you brought also, Chrissy.
It is. I think it's really interesting. I read something where Jessica Love was saying she was working on white paper like she normally does, and she just could not get the skin color correct. So she started working on brown paper, and it just opened up, and I just thought that was very interesting because the default is white paper.
Yeah.
And she moved to brown paper and felt the skin colors were so much more alive and real. So even though she is a white woman, she thought about her process for the illustration.
It wasn't, in other words, contrived, like, oh, this has to be about.
No, in that interview, you can tell she is working very hard to be responsible, or at least that's my take on it. And and that she said, like, she created it at a time when she was dating somebody this is who she imagined their child might be. Like, this is who their child might look like. She didn't say anything more, and I don't know her to know anymore, but you could tell that she was working hard to be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not own voices. Like, it's, I need to.
Right. So hashtag own voices. To identify people who are writing about someone who could be themselves.
Yes, okay. And it's Corinne Dalvis. Corinne Dalvis, who started the hashtag Own Voices, and I believe that she is on the autism spectrum, and that she is a writer, and that she's the one who is just reminding us to pay attention to that. It's not foolproof, but it's a starting point.
Well, which brings us to another issue. We've talked about LGBTQ, gender identity, ethnicity, religion, color of skin, that whole thing. But then there is things like being on the spectrum, being disabled in any way, and depicting that in a I hate to use the word realistic, but authentic, that's mm-hmm, a better word, mm-hmm. And knowledgeable way.
Right. And some of the pitfalls that people fall into when they're writing and thinking around mental illness in particular are kind of glamorizing it or making it be like this, the only characteristic of this person, and ignoring the other characteristics that the character has, and making it be like they basically use their illness in a way that like propels them forward or something that has
everything
to be a big success story.
Around right. The disability or the characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Issue books for picture books where that's the only thing. So people will pull that out when they think it's relevant but won't read that story any other time.
Huh. Are there any good examples of using whether at whatever kind of disability, developmental, emotional, physical – in a positive way, but in an authentic, natural way.
Yeah. One of my students, Alyssa Chrisman, shared with our class "The Princess and the Fog" by Lloyd Jones, and I thought that worked.
What was
really
it about?
So it's about depression, and it's it's represented in a way that felt more about the feelings than a diagnosis, for example. And a young adult book that we used in the class around the same time was A.S. King's I Crawl Through It, which I think also pays more attention. It's not a diagnosis story. It's about how characters are feeling and
surviving and living.
And surviving and enduring. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Huh. So that's what I'm looking for in books that are representing mental illness.
And for picture books, there's been a really good book this year about someone who has a brother with autism. It's called Benji, Me and the Bad Day. So the me in the title has a bad day, and Benji is the one with autism, and he helps his big brother feel a lot better. And it's just a story about being brothers, and one of them has autism.
We are talking about diversity in children's literature. That's Chrissy Harris. She's selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Also with me, Molly Blackburn, Ohio State professor. She studies literacy, language, and social change. And coming up, we're going to hear from a blog writer who dedicates her blog to diversity in children's literature and see what she has to say. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question, your comment there. We're looking for, recommendations. Holidays are coming up and, there's lots of time to read. So give us a call. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of a diversity of characters and stories in children's and young adult literature. Reading from an early age is important. What you read matters as well. And when it comes to children's literature, fewer than a third of all books were written by and or about people of color or Native Americans. And we're talking about the dearth of diversity in children's literature, how that affects early learning. Still with us is selection librarian at Columbus Metropolitan Library, Chrissy Harris, also OSU professor whose research focuses on literacy, language, and social change, Molly Blackburn. And joining us now, Sharnay Gordon. She writes a blog dedicated to diversity in children's literature. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Sharnay.
Thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to start the blog?
So I started my blog back in February of 2015, really just as a way for me to keep track of all of the books that I was reading with my two children. They are currently ages 5 and 6. And really to keep track of all the books I was reading with them, as well as books I was reading myself. People would also always asked me for book recommendations for their children, so I just decided to start blogging about it.
You have a project called 50 States, 50 Books. What's that about?
Correct. So it's a family community service project where myself, my two children, and occasionally my husband will get involved. We're basically collecting 50 diverse children's books and donating them to organizations nationwide throughout the U.S. So we are collecting 50 diverse children's books for each of the 50 U.S. states. And there's an application process where people who are interested, it could be a school, a library, or an individual even, but the, you know, they have to be in need of diverse books for children. We've completed so far 32 out of the 50 states, which is over 1,500 books. I can't even count, but we've donated so many books to various schools and libraries across the country, and it's been a really great project.
Has it been hard to come up with that many titles?
It has not. We were fortunate enough in the beginning, like with the first 13 states, we did that all on our own. Like people, and the way that people send us books is through my, I was kind of using my social media page on Instagram primarily to kind of talk about the project, and people just started following along and were excited about it. And people, just random people on the internet, just send us books to our P.O. box, which has been amazing. So for the first 13 states, we did all of that on our own. For the next 16 states, word has been getting around about our project. We were featured in Huffington Post as well as in Money-ish. We were also featured on our local TV morning talk show. But just through, I think it was through the Huffington Post article, one of the major publishers found out about our project and donated 800 books to our project. So that took care of another 16 states for us. So that's 30. And then we just completed two additional states on our own.
What are some of the favorite books that you recommend, Sharnay Gordon?
Oh, yeah, there's so many. I aim to read to my kids. I don't only read diverse books to my children. I aim to read like a wide array of books to my children, and that includes everything from like classics to new releases to nonfiction. But I do tend to read a lot of books with characters that are black or brown, primarily because I just believe that it's important to read enriching books that include people of all colors, not just black and brown people. But I think it's particularly, you know, important for children so that they can imagine being like the people that they see in these books. And it's also critical for children to be reminded constantly that they can achieve anything. And I believe one of the best ways to do that is through books. So I tend to read, you know, some of our favorites are just talking about this year, because I have so many favorites. Some of my favorites from this year that have been released are Jacqueline Woodson, The Day You Begin.
That's a beautiful book. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Wonderful. Anyone can understand and relate to that book. Everyone's been that new kid or the first, you know, it's kind of like the new kid in class sort of a thing.
The only kid.
Yeah, there's also another beautiful book this year that we loved called I Am Enough by Grace Byers. Just a beautiful book to affirm to any child that they are enough. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what you look like, how you dress. Everything about you is just enough, just the way that you are.
I'm going to turn to Peggy now in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I have taught grade school. I just retired a couple of years ago, and I taught. My specialty was children's literature, and I just wanted to mention a couple of authors I think I used in my classroom extensively. One is Floyd Cooper. He was a guest in our school twice, and his artwork is absolutely outstanding. And he writes some of them and then illustrates some for others. And then another one is Margaret Taylor, who may not still be living, but she wrote Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and a whole series about that family. And every year I used her gold Cadillac in my room to illustrate the difference, what somebody else's life is like that could be a little more difficult than yours in some situations. And I'm trying to find this. There's a whole family of writers and artists, and my wife's name is Gloria, and I can't think of the rest of their name. But anyway, there's just rich culture out there, beautifully written and illustrated. And I know my classroom, in my room, we really loved them. And so I just thought I'd mention that.
Thank you, Peggy. I appreciate that. Floyd Cooper and Margaret Taylor. Thanks for your call.
Mildred Taylor.
Mildred
Taylor. If you're looking for her, just look for Mildred Taylor.
Okay, Mildred. Sorry about that.
No, it's great. Mildred Taylor. I love her work, and I want to just make sure people can find it.
You know, it makes me wonder if there are people who are writing in this genre with that recognition of diversity, you know, pick your flavor, a long time ago, but just weren't getting published because it was perceived as not publishable, not sellable. Do we know anything about that?
I feel certain that's the case. I feel certain that's the case. Yeah. I'm thinking of the
what's been lost in the shuffle.
Right. Yeah. Right. And kind of also intentional shuffle sometimes, not always unintentional. Mm-hmm. I know I'm thinking of the Mildred Taylor books. When I taught middle school in Georgia in like the mid 90s, those were like on our bookshelves. Those were something we could, mm-hmm. you know, pull off and teach. And, they felt like a really good start. They felt like, I mean, it feels like a long time ago, but it also feels like it was really productive work to talk with across race with kids about our kind of insidious racial history in the United States.
Hmm. Yeah, they're definitely historical fiction. And I think now there's so much current fiction that's being published. And in the past, maybe it was safe to write about historical fiction.
Right.
That got published. But now everyday lives are getting published a little more.
Yeah.
That's a great point, Percy.
You know, Charnay, there's also the issue of reading books with children, right?
Right.
And being there with them while they're reading them. I used to love it. I can't get my 22-year-old to sit on my lap anymore and do that. But what about that? You have kids, right?
I do. Yeah, I do. Story time for us is one of our favorite parts of the day. I love the, you know, just being connected and then being able to see their eyes light up when they see something of interest to them, or if they see something that makes them scared, happy, you know, something that makes them laugh. I just think it's just important to share that time with them and be able to, once you're done with the story, be able to reflect on what you've read, what you've learned. So just asking, you know, very, very basic discussion questions after the book, especially if you have small kids.
Yeah.
But, you know, just very basic questions. And, you know, even as you're reading, like, how do you think this person is feeling? You know, just based on the illustration or maybe based on the context, you know, the text that's written in the book. How do you think, you know, this person is feeling? How would you feel if that happened to you? That type of thing.
I think it's really important to scaffold reading, whether it's done by parents and teachers. Duran and Jimenez Garcia talk about, like, not only do we need mirrors and windows, but we need lenses through which we might more aptly perceive the nuanced and complex identities of youth of color
so
in literature.
So how would we do that? What do you mean?
Well, by scaffolding reading, by asking about what's going on here. What do you notice?
Kind of start with the cover of the book. Sometimes I was taught, you know, what is this cover? What do you think this book is about?
Right.
That kind of a thing?
That kind of thing. Yeah. And what's happening between these characters? I'm thinking of the Julian as a Mermaid book. There's a time when the main character's grandmother steps out of the room and comes back in, and he's more dressed up, and there's this moment where you don't know whether she's going to be furious with him or whether or what she's going to do. And to talk with kids about what's happening here. What about the tension between these two characters? And then the grandmother is just like fully embracing, like really very loving.
But you can talk about the alternative possibilities and, and get kids thinking like that.
And we all know how much kids love to reread stories because it just—
Yes, we do.
And it just gives you a chance to revisit those questions and talk about it and help them process it even more.
Yeah. Yeah. You write a little bit about that, don't you, Sharnay Gordon, the reread?
I do. Yes, I do.
Yes. Walter in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Walter.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call in.
I'm
really intrigued in listening to everyone in your audience speak about real life stories, especially coming from a Black perspective that has diversity. And I just had to call in. I have a memoir, and what inspired me to write my book, of course, was when I was incarcerated, wrongfully incarcerated, and DNA testing freed me 22 years ago. But that wasn't the catalyst of writing my book. The problem didn't start with being wrongfully incarcerated. The problem started in watching my parents, who would party around holidays and never sit down and talk to us about drugs or alcohol, and then we as children started experimenting. So I set it as my goal to write Street Soldier, which is my memoir, written on a sixth grade level. And it is so apropos because of the drug problem we have out here now with heroin. I don't think we're doing enough to reach the babies.
And you know, we've been talking about how do you make the point of, you know, what's appropriate. You're saying it's written at the sixth grade level, but, you know, from a librarian's point of view, Chrissy Harris, what do you think? Are kids ready to read about these issues that Walter's bringing up?
No, definitely. We've mentioned Jacqueline Woodson a couple of times, and there's books about a book that she's written about incarcerated parents. It is an important topic for all ages.
Is that the one, Harbor Me? Or
no, this is a picture
visiting
book.
Day.
Yes, Visiting Day. Thank you.
Oh, Visiting Day. Okay, that's right. Yeah. Walter, thanks a lot. It's how do we know, how does one know, Molly Blackburn, what's appropriate?
Right. One of the things that I think, again, it's about like our parents are protecting, our kids are ready. But Meg Medina, who wrote Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, it's a young adult book. And she writes, the truth is that in this life, you may meet many amazing and wonderful people, but you'll also meet many broken and violent ones who will make just as much of an impact on you. And literature can prepare you for such experiences. And so that to me is like, that's how you make the decision, that you want your kids to be prepared for all of the people they'll encounter, not just the people you wished they would encounter.
Yeah. I had a bully in grade school. Would love to have read about that kind of a person and understood it better. Sharnay Gordon, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything that people have said. I mean, obviously, my kids are, you know, 5 and 6. So those kind of topics, they, you know, may or may not come up. We have read Visiting Day before by Jacqueline Woodson, but at a very kind of basic level, just to read it, not really getting into any sort of deep discussion about, you know, what incarceration is and, you know, just anything like that. I don't believe that my kids are ready for those types of discussions.
My experience around being ready is really important. So, I focus on LGBT literature, and one of the things I've noticed is that picture books mostly are written about family, so that they're about having two moms, for example. I'm thinking of In Our Mother's House by Patricia Polacco, or The Two Dads represented in And Tango Makes Three with the Penguins. And they're about families. And then when they become the young adult literature for adolescents, then they're focused on kids experiencing same-sex desire. And so I'm thinking of I'll Give You the Sun, or Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe. These are books that it becomes appropriate. The focus of LGBT content, I think, like what parents sometimes think, this is just not appropriate for my kid. The books are not about same-sex desire when they're picture books for little kids. They're about families, which is totally appropriate.
Being,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, Molly Blackburn,
thanks
so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Molly Blackburn, OSU professor. She studies literacy, language, and social change. And Sharnay Gordon, thanks to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sharnay Gordon, creator of Here We Read, that's a blog dedicated to children's literature. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. And Chrissy Harris, selection librarian at Columbus Metropolitan Library, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our interns Martin Coleman, Kaylin Martin, Macy Glockner, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.